You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is July 13th. It is 2023. It's 7:36 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Apparently, Lucy wants to join our discussion. And we've been talking the last couple of weeks about relationships and building social networks. And I thought that we would finish up that topic by talking about Dunbar's research on relationships and patterns of relationships that make you happy. But I also wanted to say that we're going to change the format of this evening by making the first Thursday of the month a level one for the meditation and attachment curriculum. And so on the first Thursday of the month, we'll begin to talk about the meditation and attachment system. And we'll do that every month going forward, starting on August, the first Thursday in August. And then the other three Thursdays will continue to be, I love you, keep going. But I'm finding more and more that there needs to be a regular introduction to that curriculum. And so we've been working it out what to do, and that's where we landed. So we'll give it a try and see how it goes. Robin Dunbar is a British researcher, and he originally asked the question, is there a limit to the capacity of the human mind to recognize faces? And so he began to research that, and what he discovered was that there is an active buffer of memory, an active buffer where the capacity to recognize 3D representations of faces is, I'm not saying this very well, that there is an active buffer of memory that stores about 150 faces that can be recognized pretty quickly, and that those are 3D faces. And that number is about 150. Did I say that in a way that makes sense? So the human mind can recognize about 150 faces in 3D pretty readily, and that's the size limit of it. In the later research, he did discover that the body mind recognizes 2D representations of faces differently than 3D representations, and that the 2D representation of faces is quite a bit bigger than that 150 number. You know, we were all saying, well, I have 5,000 friends on Facebook. How can the capacity to recognize faces possibly be limited to 150? So it turns out that there's a big difference between recognizing 3D faces and recognizing 2D faces. Once he discovered that number, he decided he would look to see whether there were structures in human society that were around those numbers. And so what he discovered was that historical institutions like, say, the Roman Legion were divided into divisions of 150, and that many policing organizations around the world use that number to determine how many police are necessary to keep order. And because in social groups, large social groups where you can recognize everybody in the social group and you know who they are, the groups themselves are self-policing. But as soon as the numbers exceed that, where you don't really know or recognize everybody, the self-policing systems break down and some kind of order is necessary. Then what he wanted to look at is, how many people do you actually have to know to be happy, to have a sense of being connected in the world? And that was quite different than the larger group of 150. What he noticed was that there was a sharp division between closeness in the way that we've organized things, that there's an above the line where you tell people everything, and there's a below the line where you tell people some things. The above the line, what we mean by tell them everything, is that you give them a complete and accurate representation of your experience of the present moment. Doesn't mean you haul out the scroll of every terrible thing that you've ever done and get them to initial by each one so that you feel a sense that they won't abandon you as soon as they find that out. That this is just your willingness to tell somebody your authentic experience of the present moment. Now, in secure attachment systems, that's basically the way that relationships are modeled. You have people that are close to you, and that the way that you gauge the closeness is your willingness to tell them your experience of what's happening without the fear of being abandoned if you do. And then in insecure and disorganized attachment, the capacity to be authentic is greatly limited because of the fearfulness of being abandoned if you actually represent yourself. We can look at that in that the way in which these attachment relationships form and understand that we don't actually see ourselves without the reflection of ourselves from someone else. It's too easy to get lost and distorted in mind representations. We don't know each other in another way than that. You present yourself authentically to somebody, they understand what you've or they react to what you've experienced, and they reflect back to their experience of you in that moment. And that's how we begin to understand who we are and how what we're thinking and feeling registers. In infancy, of course, the main caregiver is the one that we're focused on, and our capacity, our whole world is really that face that's reflecting back to us their experience of us. And we begin to construct a working model of who we are based on those reflections. So we might think that we're completely delightful in any situation because the reflection of who we were in each of those moments of expression was one of delight in being with us. Or we could have had a caregiver that was overwhelmed by the experience of us, and what was reflected back to us was their sense of fearfulness, their sense of overwhelm. Or maybe they were annoyed and angry by the way that we presented ourselves, and so we understood ourselves to be somebody who was annoying, somebody who was difficult. And we began to construct a working model of ourselves that's based on those reflections. Is that making sense? So the capacity to be authentic is really dependent on our expectation of what will happen if we express ourselves authentically. And this really comes from the early childhood period when there's no capacity to express in another way than what's authentically happening. As you grow older and have a greater capacity to understand the reactions of other people to you, you can begin to navigate and present in ways that are different than completely authentic if the authentic expression is not received. I think that those of us who learned inauthenticity did so because there was no other choice, and it was a bitter lesson, a painful lesson, to begin to present ourselves in a way that the other person needed us to present, rather than as a celebration of who we are, what our understanding was in that moment. So that above the line grouping of people are people that you can express your experience of the present moment without so much fear of abandonment that you begin to deflect or change that authentic expression into an inauthentic one, an insecure and disorganized relationship. Authentic expression is not valued so much. Below the line are people that you tell some things to, not everything. Lucy's off to express her authentic opinion of the world. So we also can talk about collaborative relationship systems and transactional relationship systems and trauma bonding as main of ways of forming relationships. In intimate collaborative relationships, authenticity is highly valued. And you really pay attention to who receives you and understands you and who appreciates you, who delights in you, and you value those relationships and direct your energy toward them. In transactional relationships, it's more role-based. They perform a series of tasks for you and you reward them. You perform a series of tasks for them and they reward you. And then in trauma bonding, of course, you're not actually in relationship to the person you are with. You're in relationship to the idea of the person. They're in relationship to you, not as who you are, but the idea of who maps onto their trauma patterning. When we talk about intimate collaborative relationships, we're also talking about this capacity for authenticity in relationships where you feel safe and free to express yourself authentically. And Dunbar was looking at this and saying, how many of those relationships do you actually need to feel connected and happy? And the number I thought was surprisingly low. Some people like to have central organizing relationships, what we would call an A relationship, somebody that you take care of on a daily or every other day basis, somebody that you tell everything to. Most people like to have a sexual component to that relationship because it's so resource intensive. But then this also points to aspects of sexual orientation. Are you on the monogamous end of the scale? Are you on the polygamous end of the scale? Hardcore monogamy really is not flexible so much that you can adapt to a more open relationship structure, whereas truly poly people can adapt to a monogamous situation more easily. But this is a characteristic of your sexual orientation is usually pretty fixed. And then we have gay, straight, and in between. I think the most malign group in our culture are bisexuals. Gay people think that they should just come out finally, and straight people think they should just come out finally. And they're stuck in the middle with the experience of arousal that goes in more than one direction. We have also the gender. The early research that came out of John Hopkins that John Money did on gender, I think, if I remember correctly, had 8 points of gender, 5 of which were prenatal and 3 of which were postnatal, partly about the hormonalization, the masculinization and the demasculinization, or the fem. How does one say this? But we're all born. We all start as a female, that's the default. And then depending on the sperm and the fertilization, we either go in an XX pattern, which is female, or an XY pattern, which is male. The brain structure then in male zygotes is defeminized and then masculinized, but that doesn't always happen for everybody in the same way. It's conceivable that you could have a brain as a male that wasn't defeminized, but masculinized. You could have a brain that was feminine and not masculinized. you could be a female, start off as a female zygote, then have a brain that was defeminized and masculinized. So there's a large range of things that can happen in the process of gestation. And then you're born, of course, and you have secondary genitalia, which is triggering of identification of sex, and then the kind of socializing that tends to produce. And so you have the sex assignment, the cultural conditioning of that. And then, of course, you have, as adolescence begins, the capacity to choose your own identity. Tom?
Sorry. And so right at the beginning of this part, you said that Dunbar A classifications tended to be sexual because of something about resources? Or
Yes.
Why was it that they tend to be sexual?
Well, you need to, in an A relationship, you're taking care of somebody on a daily or every other day basis. And the other quality of that is that the needs of the relationship are put in primary position and your solo exploration needs are put in secondary position, so that the relationship needs take precedent over your solo exploration needs. That's a huge commitment of time, energy, and resources. And because of that, people who like to have sexual experiences tend to sexualize those relationships. So obviously not necessary. You look at the statistics of 60% of marriages being sexless after 5 years. It really does depend on, I'd like to say, how well your sexuality emerged from the vicissitudes of your upbringing.
Thank you.
I'd like to say we're all born with a slick, smooth, sexy sports car of a sexual orientation. And by the time we're old enough to drive, it's a banged up old jalopy. That also then points to the family system you grow up in, often a class system that you grew up in. Did you come from a reasonably resourced family or a very well resourced family? And were the things that made understanding life in the way that we live it easy for you? Were you born without resources? And so there was a constant challenge and struggle. And that because of that, your parents were, or parent were in such difficult shape that they weren't able to provide for you that the security of an environment that would help you develop a sense of security, a sense of safety in the world. When we talk about attachment, of course, we're really talking about this sense of safety, this sense of security, which allows the attachment system to shut down and the exploration system to turn on, so that you can then be engaged most of the time in exploring things that have real meaning to you, and not in a place of fearfulness, so that the exploration system never really engages and you're constantly seeking reinsurance and safety from the people around you. There's another relationship above the line, which I call, and I think also Dunbar called, B relationships. B relationships are people that you see weekly or every other week, that you also tell everything to, that you take care of. But the main difference between A and B relationships is that in B relationships, your personal exploration is still in primary position and the needs of the relationship are in secondary position. Then below the line, the closest group is the C group. That's 30 to 40 people for most adults. And then the D group is rounding out the remaining 150. That was the original research. He's modified it a little bit in multiples of three, really. He talks about it A relationships than B relationships. 3 to 5 people, maybe. And then in C relationships, there's a band of closeies, maybe 15 people that are like Bs in a lot of respects, but you don't have the bandwidth to maintain the relationships at a more intimate and a constant level. But that's the place you go to fill up your intimate relationships. If one of the relationships should fail, that leaves about 30 people in the rest of the band, and then 150 or so. Then there's a larger group of 1,500 people, and 1,500 people are people, are faces that you can recognize and that you can make some association to. So, you know, in our media-driven culture, it's likely that you can recognize dozens or more faces of people that are prominent and appear often in media without ever having any real contact with them. People that you know certain things about, but you don't know or have never met. And then there's a wider group that tops out at about 5,000, which are, there's a statistical significance about whether you've seen that face or not seen that face. Does that make sense? And then, so that's the whole picture of the mind and its capacity to recognize faces. But in Dunbar's research at looking for who's happier, what he found was that he calls it one and a half in terms of the A's, that the happiest people in committed couples are people that have a designated person that can hear everything about the relationship and be used as a sounding board by one person in the partnership. And that sometimes if each person has that designated person, that is, that it's agreeable to the other person in the A relationship to hear everything about the relationship, that those people tend to be the happiest in their A relationship. So, and because the needs of the relationship are primary and the secondary exploration is secondary, and those relationships, you really do need to have the other person agree that you can express openly what's going on in the relationship to someone else. And if that isn't agreeable to the partner, you really shouldn't violate that confidence by discussing it somewhere else. That making sense? But the happiest people have designated people that you can use as a sounding board to make sense. Remember, we really understand ourselves as it's reflected back from someone else. When you're in a primary relationship with someone else and they're so central to your life, if there's a conflict in the relationship, the sense of who you are can be quite distorted. And so it's useful to have that possibility of another reflection. It's also useful to have Bs. So what he also found in the happiest group is that each of the partners in the A relationship have a number of secondary relationships that are intimate, that are emotionally regulating. The reason that this makes people happy is because you have alternatives to only one person being emotionally regulating. That also allows them to, and you also, to have your solo exploration. If you really center your life on one person and only have one regulating relationship, you're dependent on them to regulate you if you get dysregulated. And so that means they have to be available to you, which can be inhibiting either to your exploration because you can't separate from them, or their exploration because they can't separate from you. If you have that B level of relationships, then they can go off and you're not bereft of somebody to regulate you because your B group can regulate you. And you can go off and they won't be left without a regulator. Is that making sense? And then the C group, 30 to 40, the D group, rounding up to 150. Dunbar also discovered that that was not the most common formulation. In the West, the most common formulation was to have one A relationship, no B relationships, no close C relationships, and just general Cs. And that made people much less happy and much more dependent on their A relationship. I should also say that not everybody wants to have an A relationship. There's no obligation to do that. Many people have B relationships, multiple B relationships, some with or more than one with sexual components to it. And then that's a totally valid model for being in a relationship. We get very heteronormative in terms of how we think relationships should be. And this is, again, part of this structure of your sexual orientation, which is pretty fixed. And so part of this, of course, is to really look deeply at what's arousing for you. And then also understand that just because it's arousing for you, you don't have license to then engage in that activity in the world without consent of other people. And that means you have to have people who are capable of consent. So again, this is pointing toward authenticity. Can you express what your desires and interests are to somebody in an authentic way? And can you hear their response to that? And then adapt to their permission? And can they adapt to your permission in the radio, your relationship, your consent? We tend to notice and develop our understanding of consent in relationships by modeling what happens in our family system. Did you grow up in a family system where consent was routinely negotiated and people and the caregivers in your family system came up with a win-win scenario so that both people were satisfied with that? Or did you grow up in a family system where the power dynamic was not like that? I grew up in a family system where my father's choice was the choice, and it was never even negotiated. It was never negotiated. It was just what it was. There wasn't the possibility for that, and so that's the modeling I really understand at that original family system level. So I tend to be hypersensitive about consent in relationships because it was absent. Is that all making sense so far? So you can begin, and I think one of the things that's important about considering this is that you can begin to map what your pattern in relationship is, and you can then begin to recognize where you have assets and where you have deficits, and you can begin to develop the deficits so that you have a more robust relationship network that supports you. The main advantage of this is that with a lot of social support, you're much freer to explore at a much deeper level, a much more meaningful level, because you have the support you need. If you get knocked sideways and can't emotionally regulate yourself as you're exploring. But you do have to tend to the garden of these relationships, which takes a lot of time, energy, and resources. One of the biggest difficulties that insecure and disorganized people have around putting these social networks in place is they don't see the value of the relationships. They don't see the value of the attachment enough to be willing to put the amount of time, energy, and resources into the relationships that secure functioning relationships require. their experience of relationships has not been that productive. And so they don't see the value of it. And so in withholding the energy, the time, energy, and resources from relationships which are necessary to support secure functioning relationships, you self-select out of having them. And it's also self-reinforcing. You don't put the energy in, so you don't have them. And so you begin to believe the representation that these relationships aren't available. Do understand that we're all in the same boat. We all need these social networks to support our solo exploration. And if we're not doing enough solo exploration, we're often in a state of despair in being alive. And even in privileged societies, I notice in the meditation communities, at least the ones that I'm involved in, there's a fairly high level of privilege that most people have. Even in privileged communities, this human life is difficult and hard to do. And as you get older, the amount of energy that you have diminishes, it gets harder and harder to do it. When you have insecure, disorganized relationships, it takes a ton of energy just to stabilize the relationship. So the energy that you might use to explore is consumed by stabilizing unstable relationships. But secure functioning relationships don't really operate in that way. You open a topic that needs to be negotiated. You negotiate a way to be in relationship to each other with that subject matter. And you come to an agreement that is a win-win. In secure functioning relationships, you don't accept win-lose relationships because you understand that they don't settle. You can't expect somebody to persist in a win-lose relationship without demanding a renegotiation. But in a win-win situation, you can settle conflicts in relationships, and then you don't have to attend to them because there's an agreement that people keep and that settles it. And so in secure functioning relationships where more and more of these agreements are made, less and less energy is necessary to stabilize the relationship. They tend to run pretty smoothly. And then that frees up that energy that you can, so that you can use it to focus on your exploration. Not making sense. But you have to change your mind and see the value of secure functioning relationships so that you'll put the time, energy, resources into them. And then you need to really reflect on what it is that you need to get out of a relationship that supports your exploration so that you can be engaged in the world and find meaning in the world. And then part of that process of intimacy is sharing authentically what you've discovered in your exploration with the expectation that the person that you're sharing it to, that you're intimately involved with, will delight in you and your discoveries. And that you then, as they go out into the world and discover things and come back and express them to you, will be interested and delighted in what they found. And that's one of the main energies of secure functioning relationships, this expression of each other's exploration and the meaningfulness of that. Is that making sense? So the happiest people have an A if they want it. They have 2 to 5 Bs. They have 15 close Cs. They have 30 to 40 people in the C group, 150 people all together, including the D group. You're hearing me about how much time, energy, and resources that's going to take to put that social network in place. And that if you're securely functioning, most of that's probably already there. And if you're insecurely functioning or disorganized, you'll notice that that structure is not really there. So I do want to emphasize again that everybody's in the same boat on this. Everybody's looking for these kinds of supportive, intimate relationships. It's the nature of the human condition. It's even the physical structure of the brain, which has these bundles of neurons that are only found in mammals and other species that have complex social networks. They're not found in lizards. Not to disparage lizards. I was reading with some amusement a conspiracy theory about lizard people, which I won't get into. Is that all making sense, Matt?
Just going back a minute, if someone is in an insecure relationship and one partner is doing this attachment work, is there any other, any other option other than both partners need to do it, or the outcome of one, the partner that does it is that they choose, they leave and they choose more wisely, or is there any other option there?
If one person does it and the other person doesn't do it, the person who doesn't do it would have to be open to renegotiating a lot of the agreements. Mostly deal breakers don't change that much. When you talk about deal breakers, things that you have to have in the relationship and things that you can't have in the relationship aren't that many usually. And relationships, whether they're secure or not, if they have deal breakers, those relationships don't survive much anyway. But if you have a relationship that where there are no deal breakers in it, and you've made different kinds of negotiations with your partner, typically the person who does the attachment work is not going to be able to keep the agreements. So it isn't, and the partner who doesn't do the work is right in saying, I'm not the one who needs to change these agreements. You're the one who needs to change the agreements. And so there needs to be an acknowledgement that as you do the attachment work and you can no longer tolerate the agreements that you've made, that you're the one who's reneging on them, and then inviting a process of renegotiation and seeing if you can come into more balance where it's a kind of win-win situation. That makes sense. Oftentimes that can happen, and oftentimes it can happen within the partnership where you're successful in negotiating the relationship with your partner. Sometimes you need to go into some kind of couples work where there's a referee, and then there is some relationships that aren't renegotiable. I would say that, if you're in a relationship with somebody and there's some degree of intimacy, you're in the relationship because you value the person. And so it makes sense to the other person to renegotiate. The other thing that can happen, which is very typical, is that the relationship has already failed and you come into the attachment work with the idea that you might be able to save the relationship, but in the relationships that have already failed, that typically doesn't happen. They come apart quicker. Good enough?
Yes, thank you.
I think one of the things that also is something that needs to happen is this capacity to hold the experience of the other person with delight, the capacity to hold them in a positive light. So we also recommend that you do the divine abodes as a constant practice so that you can really create these working models of other people that are positive and delighting, so that you have the capacity for compassion. In relationships with other people, the far enemy of compassion is cruelty. And you'll notice that in sometimes in relationships where there's a failure of compassion, that one person responds instead with cruelty. They're disconnecting from the suffering of the other person because they can't bear it, but they do it with cruelty or indifference. And you know, you really are in a secure functioning relationship, you really are taking on the care of the other person. And you're interested in doing a good job at taking care of them so that they feel well taken care of, which means you're taking care of them in a way that's meaningful to them, not in a way that's meaningful to you. One of the things I notice in the couples work I do often is that one person takes care of the other person in the way that they would like to be taken care of and are angry about the fact that their partner confronts them over and over again, feeling uncared for, and they don't really understand it. There's a mentalizing piece there. Can you mentalize well enough to know what your partner needs, recognize the signals, and then just provide that care to them? So that they feel seen, they feel understood, they feel known, they feel accepted. And they also feel safe because you know what to do to help them when they need help. And then they do that for you so that you feel seen, you feel understood, you feel known, you feel accepted, and you feel safe that they know how to handle you. They know what to do for you if you get into trouble and you can't do it for yourself. Making sense. And so it's this active engagement of care that doesn't depend on them telling you what to do. They do have to tell you in the beginning, and maybe they tell you 3 or 4 or 8 times, but at some point you're supposed to be able to recognize what's going on with them and just do it, because that's the agreement of that A-level relationship, and even to some extent in the B relationships. One of the things that is so meaningful on the receiving end of care is if somebody sees what you need and they just do it because they know you, right? They want to be good at taking care of you. And then you do that for them. They feel seen and known, understood, and you feel seen and known and understood and protected. That's the thing that creates that sense of security in the relationship. Whereas if, you know, the 87th time or the 295th time you have to ask them to do the same thing, then it begins to be that they don't see you, they don't know you. They're not willing to take care of you, which is what creates a lot of friction. Anything else about that? I think it's a nice way to think about relationships and think about where you are in terms of putting your social group together so that you have the network available to you that will support you so that you can explore to the point that you see this life, this world, as a place of beauty and interest and satisfaction. Then understand that if you're in despair, which happens quite a bit, that you don't see the world as that way, that really needs to be some attention to your primary exploration, the pursuit of meaning, that you can come into that understanding. So why don't we do some meditation practice some heart practice. We'll do some practice for an easy person and then for self. You really want to do the heart practices for self until the sense of self, the experience of self, is delightful. that you enjoy the experience of yourself as it manifests. I'm going to abandon using the bell, and I'll just tell you when we're beginning and when we're ending vocally. So go ahead and take your meditation posture. We'll begin. Closing the eyes, settling in the body, scanning through the body, looking for any tension you might be holding, seeing if you can release it. All right, come out of the meditation. Any comments or questions? Okay.
I have one.
Okay.
So when I am doing the initial part and you're guiding us to choose an easy person, and that's right. an easy person to send or feel loving kindness with and for, right?
Right.
And so the person I chose, the same one I chose last weekend, it's a person who already has the qualities of peace. And so when I'm saying may you be peaceful, it's like that person embodies peacefulness and seems to live it. So why would I be saying may you be peaceful? Because they're just already there. And so that's a confusing part for me with just that little segment. And then I try to change, but I will say that I during that time, even though I was having this extra examination of the, you know, why am I sending may you be peaceful when this person is already embodying peace. So then I just started to feel the energy of, I could actually physically have a feeling tone with it.
Good.
So that part felt like, okay, well, at least I'm on the right track. And then I experiment a lot when you're guiding, because I have this habit of getting distracted and analytical. And so I was like, well, maybe I should try may you live a long and healthy life. Because you always say, you know, you don't have to use may you be peaceful. But that felt cumbersome and it got me all off track. And then I'm like, I'm confusing myself. And then when it turned to may I be peaceful, I was still trying to piggyback on the other person. Yeah.
Has anybody ever said to you that you might be overthinking this?
Yeah, that's why I bring it up. That's okay. Why I bring it up, because how do I break that habit of overthinking?
So when you notice that the mind is thinking, focus, push more of your attention onto the object.
And the object being the person who...
The mind state. That peaceful quality. Put more of your attention on that peaceful quality.
So drop the language of may you be peaceful, may you be peaceful. Just,
yeah, just why not just say peaceful?
That would help. That's simplifying. That's a step.
Yes. And each time you notice, so that's thought, the thoughts are coming out like the siren to grab you. Put wax in ears and lash yourself to the mast and don't listen to the thoughts that are coming for you. Just let them come and go in the background. Don't attend to them.
Right. And it's always the thought of, could I do it this way? Or why is it happening this way? You know, it's just over meta-analyzing. And so, it's a habit. I know it's a habit that I have. And so I'm trying to break that habit.
Right.
And you're saying during these guided meditations with you or whenever I'm doing it, to let that over analytical mind just be there.
Just let it be in the background. Don't attend to it.
Yeah. So don't question it and challenge it and say, oh, I can't wait to ask George this question. I want an answer. And then just let it go and just simplify.
Peace. Right.
Peace. Feeling peace.
Peace.
Peace. And then is it the feeling tone I'm looking for or the view?
Or the view.
And what's the difference between the feeling tone of I'm starting to feel peaceful and calm and versus a view?
Now, when I originally explored views, I had no concept of positive views, really. So I worked with anger.
Well,
how does the world appear when my mind is enraged? And how does it appear when it's not enraged?
Uh-huh.
So then what is a common feeling state that you get into?
I guess is confusion or overanalyzing a feeling state? Agitation? I don't know.
Or agitation. How do you know that the mind is agitated, and how do you know when the mind is not agitated?
I know when the mind is agitated when it keeps grabbing for thoughts and trying to analyze them and make meaning out of them and make questions out of them. That's
a view of agitation.
Okay.
So then when the mind is not agitated, what does the self and world look like?
Well, that's what I'm trying to
do. Looking being a word for how do you experience self and world when the mind is not agitated? And how do you know that?
Well, you mean through an experience, felt right. Sense? I guess the closest I can come recently is I got this new cat that likes to sleep on my belly. And uh-huh. So I take a little midday snooze for lunch. And when it's sitting on my belly and purring and I'm laying back on the couch, I can kind of calm my mind. It's right. It's a buddy system with the cat, I think. Yeah. I'm co-regulating.
What would you call that view?
Calm and relaxed.
Okay. So you can tell the difference between calm and relaxed and agitated. And can you then explore how the world appears to you when you're calm and relaxed and how the world appears to you when you are agitated? And then what you'll begin to understand is the nature of view. The agitated view makes the world look a certain way. The calm and relaxed view makes the world look a certain way.
Okay, yeah.
And you recognize. You already recognize it. So the question is, can you mentalize what the recognition is? How do you know that you're calm and relaxed? How do you know that you're agitated? That's what we're looking for.
We're looking to exercise that.
Yes. And then beginning to develop agency. This is the loving kindness view. Can I cause this to arise when I need it? Can I use that to displace the agitated view and just have that loving kindness view?
Right. Have agency in the view. And right. With the view comes the underlying, in this case, calm, relaxed.
And then the whole world appears like that. And as long as you hold the view, it appears like that.
So I might want to substitute, because I'm very, as you've probably figured out, I'm very like, whatever people are telling me in this guidance, I'm either supposed to do it or I'm going to fight it.
Right.
And so when you're leading, you know, maybe peace with me, I'm just like, okay, I got to do that. I got to do it. It's not working. Da, da, da. So are you saying just ignore that, replace that with calm and relax?
Relax. Yeah, totally.
Okay. I'm going to train myself to not listen to you.
Okay, good. But, you know,
I mean, yeah, to an extent.
I can tell you that when I was in Myanmar, I would do one walking pass around the there in the meditation center in the mountains of outside of Pin Luin, which is near Mandalay. There was a track around the outside wall of the monastery, and you could walk it, and it would take about 20 minutes to go one time around. And so, in the afternoon, there'd be like a 4-hour period of doing walking metta. And I was coming to the conclusion of the meditation period, I listened to my mind and I realized that I was saying May all beans be pizza. May all beans be pizza.
Yeah, you said that before, and I remember it.
So that isn't it. You're not latching on to the words. We're latching on to the view. The words don't matter. They fill up auditory thinking space, so it's less grabby.
And choosing the person, is that real critical in the beginning? Because I'm always like, well, this person makes me feel at ease and peaceful because they already have peace. Yeah.
Well, you know, we hold these working models of people, and what we want is a simple relationship that has a lot of loving kindness associated with it. So that when we think of them, that's generally the direction the mind inclines. The reason that the Seda said that the short list of easy people is so important, because when you're out and about in the world and the mind gets caught up in anger, it's hard to then come into a meditative state and then pull the mind state up. But if you think of an easy person and that just displaces the anger mind state, then you just think of the easy person when you notice the mind is inclining toward anger.
Or for me, kind of, what did I call it? Chaotic thinking or overthinking?
Agitation.
Agitation was the word. Yeah, agitated mind. Yeah, okay, I realize this is just one technique among many. And
but it is, we really want to get you to understand what a view or a mind state is, because they change the perception of everything. Mm-hmm. And until you really see that they come and go and that you actually have agency to hold one or the other, it tends to cause you to believe your perception, and you slip out of active mentalizing into psychic equivalence. And in psychic equivalence, you think that you're accurately experiencing what's happening, even though it's distorted.
You just said choose one or the other. Aren't there more than two to choose from?
Mind states?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots.
Okay. So choose a different, better one.
Right. The Buddha said the five hindrances are all mind states, right? Lust, anger, restlessness and agitation, sloth and torpor, skeptical doubt. Those are all mind states. Mm-hmm. All of the heart practices, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, they're all mind states. And then I want you to also to be sensitive to the attachment mind states. This is a secure mind state, a dismissing mind state, a preoccupied mind state, a disorganized mind state. So that you have agency and you can recognize what's happening. Because if you can't recognize what's happening, you tend to believe that your perception of it is accurate, and that will lead to attention and action. Then you'll create these karmic threads that are based on distorted perception.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm getting it a little bit, little by little.
Good.
Yeah, and you want to replace it with also secure attachment qualities, like safety, delight.
Right.
One of the other ones, you know, all the secure attachments, like
I'm attunement, emotional regulation, and also the capacity to explore.
And can those be ones that I hold as views during a practice like this?
Yeah.
Like I am safe. I'm emotionally regulated with the cat.
Right. That,
okay.
Or the ideal parent figures.
Or with the ideal parent figure. Okay. All right. That's helpful. I'm slowly, slowly getting a little glimpse of this complex model. It seems complex, but maybe I'm just making it complex. Yeah.
It's complex and there are a lot of parts, but if you explore each of the parts separately, which is the Vipassana way, right? Pulling things apart and examining each part, then you can see how they work together, and it becomes easier to understand and operate.
The spokes of the wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it won't run without the spokes.
Right.
Okay. All right, thank you.
So thanks, everybody. We just started at a level two. If you want to join it, you can for another week, and then it'll close up. We're going to start level zero, as I said here. The first Thursday of the month is going to be our new level zero for meditation and attachment, and we'll talk about that. And then the other three or four Thursdays of the month will be I Love You, Keep Going. We have some level one starting, level two starting. And anyway, if you're interested in that stuff, it's on the calendar. Take a look at it. I offer this teaching freely, and I do hope that if you can, you'll be able to make a donation. Edward? You're muted.
Just regarding the level two, which I'm in, you said something about someone taking phone numbers, which I offered, and emails, which you supposedly offered, about maybe us separate from the class, interact.
I think Gazala is going to do that.
Oh, and you also said something about the possibly at the time, which would be like tomorrow, but I haven't heard anything, so I don't know if it's happening yet. That's all.
I don't either, but I can find out. And let you know.
Fine. Thank you.
All right. There's a link on the website to make a donation if you can. I really appreciate any amount. It helps support me and also the work Meta Group is doing. Happy to see you and happy to practice with you, and see you soon. Bye.